This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Go to Jason Stein in Madison to give us a quick sense, if you could, Jason, a sort of synopsis of what happened this week in the Supreme Court race. These opinion pieces from Rebecca Bradley when she was a student many years ago at Marquette University. But give us a quick sense of where that stands right now.
Oh, of course, Greg. This week, a liberal group released several columns and letters to the editor written by Justice Bradley. To her college newspaper when she was a student at Marquette University about 24 years ago. Some of these comments included referring to gays as queers, condemning drug use and saying that those groups of people were essentially killing themselves with their actions. She also compared abortion to Holocaust and the practice of slavery. And so these comments are getting attention, one, because they're controversial, and two, because we don't often get a lot of information about a sitting justice's opinions on things like abortion. So it obviously is getting attention for whether or not it shows how she might approach those issues today as a justice.
All right, so before we get into a discussion, as we're going to show a short video of Justice Bradley speaking yesterday at the Milwaukee Bar Association after a forum where she again sort of issues an apology for the statement. So let's see that video right now.
I have given a heartfelt apology and a very sincere apology, not only to everyone in the gay community, but to everyone in the state of Wisconsin for words that I expressed as a 20-year-old college student 24 years ago. I am sincerely sorry to everyone who had to read those back then and to everyone who is reading them now. I am not the same person that I was 24 years ago. I have apologized, and it's time to move on from the things that I said and did when I was a kid 24 years ago, a quarter of a century ago.
Okay, so Mary, we've seen this sort of pattern before in politics where there's something comes up, someone issues an apology and wants to put it to bed. Mm-hmm. Do you think this gets put to bed, or how do you see this playing out in this contest?
You know, I think there is a thought that this was a long time ago. She was a college student. She's had life experiences since then. I think the problem is when you look at the statements and what she wrote, they are pretty vitriolic and pretty hateful, and I do think that it raises questions among voters about how much she's evolved and if, you know, maybe she doesn't feel quite as strongly, but if she still has some of those views. And, you know, I think the words are pretty shocking to read for reporters and readers alike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jason, what's your sense of how this is going to play out there? Because this is happening in a very contested race. You've got outside groups on both sides wanting to get engaged in it. This actually came up through One Wisconsin Now, which dug this out and shared it with reporters. But do you think that apology is enough, or does this linger as an issue for voters?
It's a good question. A couple of things. One, in a Supreme Court race, it's always very difficult to gauge what voters know. I mean, I think many voters would not know Justice Bradley's name even. I mean, that's pretty common when you're talking about a Supreme Court justice. At the same time, these comments have gotten a lot of attention. There are some other comments that Justice Bradley made later in her career, including one equating post-intercourse contraception as being akin to murder. So, you know, there will certainly be, I think, a lot of scrutiny of these statements going forward, and it'll be up to voters to decide, does she have a right to be wrong as a college student, or at least controversial, or, you know, are there some things that will stick with you even if, you know, you say or do them during your college years?
But the other part of the pattern we've seen before in politics is there'll be a TV ad to follow, no doubt, and it'll probably pick up the headlines and things that were just out there. Mary, do you think this has any effect on the other side, that if people who are Bradley supporters feel like maybe they were complacent, that this seat wasn't as important because it's not a decisive one, or that they get motivated and say, look, she's under unfair attack, and we're going to come to her defense? Does that, you know, change?
Sure, yeah. And I think that if you listen to talk radio, what you'll hear is this was a long time ago. The mainstream media is attacking her. Let's move on, people, and kind of make it more story about the media attacking somebody than about her comments. And I think that's probably what we'll continue to hear, but I don't think we've seen the last of it, and I would not be surprised to see an attack ad from either her opponent or a third-party group featuring some of her comments.
All right, and Jason, let me just ask you before we move on to our next topic, and this is happening, of course, in your presidential primary. If you're Rebecca Bradley, I assume you're hoping that the Democratic side is pretty well settled with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and the Republican side isn't, to goose and boost the turnout, and the reverse
sure.
for Joanne Kloppenburg. Who do you think is going to have the advantage just on the sort of the mechanics of the race and who's coming to the polls by the time we get to the election in a few weeks?
Now that is an interesting question. You know, I think up until the Democratic race in Michigan a few days ago, it appeared as if Hillary Clinton might be clinching that nomination, and that, you know, some of the excitement and the momentum was going out of the Sanders bid. Obviously, when he wins in Michigan, which is a state that shares some demographic and economic traits with Wisconsin, he obviously did surprisingly well in Michigan, and I think his win there sort of revived his campaign somewhat. So I think that keeps his potential alive to be a factor in Wisconsin, both in the presidential race and in the judicial race for the Supreme Court.
All right. The other fact, of course, is we have races in Milwaukee, which we'll talk about in Milwaukee County as we move on. But first, before we leave Jason to get back to work on some of the stories you're working on today. Jason, can you give us a sense of the legislative session next week? We have a final day. Only the Senate is in session. This is the final scheduled day. But what's on tap for the remaining legislation for this year?
Right. So what we had is last month we had the State Assembly wrap up their work and say that they were done for the two-year session. And so now the ball's in the court of the Senate, which, you know, essentially they have the choice of passing the bills that have already passed out of the Assembly and passing them in that form, or, you know, not taking action on them, or, you know, amending them, which would be the same as not passing them. So they really have to pass the bills as they came out of the Assembly, or they'll die. Now, the bills we have include a so-called sanctuary cities bill that would prevent local governments from enacting policies that would keep their police forces from interacting with federal immigration. As well, you have some proposals by Governor Walker to address college debt, and you have some proposals to address Alzheimer's and dementia in Wisconsin.
Are there any of those, Jason, that are expected to not get done, or do you think they all will manage to
right.
get through?
The Sanctuary Cities bill has appeared to be on pretty shaky ground. The Senate Majority Leader has said that he doesn't believe there's momentum or there's support within his caucus, or a strong call within his caucus to pass that bill. We've since seen a couple conservative senators pipe up in favor of it, but right now that bill seems, its chances seem difficult. Even Governor Walker has made some critical remarks. As far as Governor Walker's college debt plans, I would expect at least most of those bills to pass, and I would also expect, you know, some other bills, bipartisan ones like the ones to address dementia, to also be approved.
All right. Let me ask Mary, because you spent many years covering the legislature in Madison. I mean, at this stage of the year, the lawmakers usually just want to get out on the campaign trail, right?
Often,
so
yeah.
I mean, looking ahead at the fall, is there any chance that one or both of the chambers flips, or are they in pretty confident for Republicans to hang on to them.
I'd be very surprised if the Assembly flips, and I think Jason would be too. The Senate, I do think that there are some more moderate districts still left, and I do think that, I don't know that it would flip, but I can see Democrats picking up some seats, and you know, maybe we'll be surprised.
Okay.
It is a presidential year.
Right, and that's where all these things come
right
together with the turnout and the changes. So with that in mind, we're going to go now to a taped segment with Craig Gilbert, our Washington Bureau Chief, looking at the state of the presidential campaign. We're joined now by Craig Gilbert, our Washington Bureau Chief, to get a current look at the state of the presidential race. So, Craig, we just had some big primaries the other day in Michigan and Mississippi, and bigger ones coming up in Florida and Ohio. Let's start on the Republican side with Marco Rubio and John Kasich. It seems like they have to win their state or get out of the race, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's Marco Rubio has won very little in this campaign. He's really struggling in a very big way, and it's both the sort of momentum and psychology of losing his own state that would be devastating, but also just in terms of delegates. I mean, we're entering the phase of the campaign where states can now allocate delegates winner-take-all, and Florida is a winner-take-all state. And so for Donald Trump, getting to a majority of delegates during the primaries, it's really, really important for him to win, start winning winner-take-all states like Florida and Ohio, but it would be devastating for Marco Rubio to lose in his own state. And John Kasich is in a somewhat similar position in Ohio. He really needs to win Ohio. He hasn't won anything. And just as important for him winning, it's a way of denying Donald Trump the math he needs to get to avoid
right,
a contested convention.
With Ted Cruz, he's sort of had a little bit of momentum going mm-hmm. now, and it seems that the establishment a little bit is coalescing around him a little bit anyways, or at least warming, or semi-warming
yep.
to him. Do you think that, is that happening? Is this, if one of these guys drops out, is it, you know, a clearer path for Cruz to?
It's maybe a little clearer, but it's still pretty cloudy. I mean, he's consolidating some support. He's clearly the number two performer in this race so far. But one of his problems is that the states that have already voted are better for him than the states to come. I mean, he does better in the South. He does better with evangelical voters. A lot of those states have already voted. The northern, midwestern, more secular states that are coming up are tougher for him.
All right, let's get the Democratic side, where we had a very narrow win for Bernie Sanders in Michigan, an unexpected
right.
narrow win the other day. What was your take on the Michigan results that came through?
Well, Bernie Sanders, you know, it was a decent state for him on paper, but he kind of overperformed. He did better with a lot of different kinds of voters. He didn't lose black voters by the margins. He was losing black voters in the South. He did better with blue-collar white voters. He kind of exceeded expectations in a lot of different ways. And so the question is, if he can replicate that pattern in some of these other big Midwestern battlegrounds that are coming up, like Ohio and Illinois on Tuesday, like Wisconsin, which could be his best state on the horizon on April 5th, that's obviously progress for him. His problem is that it's going to be extremely difficult under almost any scenario to catch Hillary Clinton when it comes to delegates.
Yeah, let's do a little comparison, because on both sides you've got a front runner and a large group
right.
or substantial group that isn't, you know, they're not necessarily well liked by a chunk of their party.
Right.
So given, you know, the Democrats, they have superdelegates, but proportional, the Republicans are moving to the winner-take-all stage, just given the mechanics of it, who is easier to stop, do you think, if you're anti-Hillary?
I think it's easier to stop Trump, just
yeah.
because of all the wild card volatility associated with Trump, and also in Hillary Clinton's case, she's helped by two things. She's helped by superdelegates, which is this kind of large fraction of delegates who are prominent in the party, and they aren't bound by how their states vote, and they overwhelmingly support Hillary at this point. And also, the Democratic allocation of delegates is proportional throughout the process, so it's harder to build up a lead, but once you've built up a lead, it's very hard for someone to erase that lead, because they can't do it in big chunks, and that's not true on the Republican side.
All right, let's finally look at the Wisconsin primary, which is getting ever closer, just a few more
right.
weeks away. What can we expect aside from a lot of visits by the candidates?
We can't expect to be on the national stage. It's the only major primary occurring in the middle of roughly a four-week period. And it's also a state with a lot of history. It's a state where the front runners have real challenges, and so it makes it attractive for the people trying to catch them. I mean, Donald Trump, in some ways, the state is good for him demographically, a lot of blue-collar white voters, but he hasn't been polling well polling well in Wisconsin for a variety of reasons. And Hillary Clinton is vulnerable here, and Bernie Sanders is neck and neck with her in the polls. And if I were Bernie Sanders, I would look at the calendar and I would circle Wisconsin as perhaps my most promising state in the next 4 weeks.
All right. Well, thanks for the update, Craig. We'll have much more to come in the coming weeks as this election gets even closer here in Wisconsin. So thank you.
Looking forward to it.
All right, we're back live, and if the conversation was about Donald Trump, that must mean we're talking about the Milwaukee mayor's race. So let's go to Mary in just a moment. We've got Dan Bice, who's joined us, our Watchdog columnist. Mary Spicuzzi, who's been following the mayor's race. Tell us about these ads that have been going back and forth where Tom Barrett is saying, you know, Bob Donovan, he's a Republican, he's sort of unstable or irrational like Trump and so forth. Where's that all coming from?
So it started out with Mayor Barrett being attacked by some third-party groups, blaming him for crime, for carjackings, pinning, saying that he thinks the city's problems can be solved with a streetcar. So he today said that the reason he decided to go negative is that if you punch him in the nose, he'll punch you right back. So he decided, his campaign issued some ads targeting Donovan, saying that he is Scott Walker, or has Scott Walker's ideas and Donald Trump's temperament. He basically today, during an edit board meeting, said that he doesn't think Bob Donovan has the temperament to be mayor, and had some examples of why he thinks so. So it is surprising because everyone thinks of Tom Barrett, nice guy, and his attack ads are not as nice.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things to me is, I mean, they're running, at least I heard them on WISN radio, which isn't probably his voters that he's going for. So he's kind of hitting Donovan with going for his strength, presumably, and hitting him on it, that he's too conservative and unstable.
It's also a little bit interesting because you would think that this race would be on a referendum on Barrett, who's been in office for 12 years, not Donovan, who's not been mayor. But I think it's because the first attack radio ad occurred on against Barrett that he felt the need to respond on radio as well. So
yeah, is it that simple, though, or are there any suggesting there's internal numbers thinking that this race is closer than people might imagine? I mean, usually, you know, the incumbent, you want to start positive for a while before you go.
And you know, he finished first with 13 percentage points, but obviously didn't get over 50%. More than half the people went to the polls voted against him, not for him. It's a little odd to me that they've made this a radio war instead of a TV battle. I mean, there are no TV ads in this, and contrast that with the county execs race, which we'll talk about in just a minute. But I'm guessing from all that I hear, the Barrett team is still pretty comfortable with where they are. I think the idea is that, you know, that it levels everything out and that it doesn't have a major impact on the race. It's also interesting, you know, both sides are using people with various different voices in these things to make their points as to one way or the other. But it's right now it's a radio war between the two sides.
Yeah. And I think Barrett's strategy is looking at, you know, his numbers might not be where he wants them to be, but Scott Walker's are certainly worse, especially in the city of Milwaukee, Milwaukee County, and so tie your opponent to Scott Walker and think of all the people in Milwaukee County who love Scott Walker. There are not that many, or city of Milwaukee, and so kind of boost his numbers by just contrasting him to.
Right. Well, I mean, an election like this, as Dan said, it's usually a referendum on the incumbent. Mm-hmm. But what? So you just heard from Mayor Barrett this morning at the editorial board. What is his, in a nutshell, case as to why he needs or deserves another term from the voters?
He talked about the city's progress in Menominee Valley and development with businesses downtown. He talked about fighting the foreclosure crisis and making a progress in that, and areas like teen pregnancy. He's more recently been touting successes with the residents' preference program of getting especially African-Americans in the city jobs. So I think that he is saying, you know, I know that we have work to do, but that I'm heading in the right direction.
It's not assimilating message that he sends.
It's
a lot of nuts and bolts sort of things, and it's not like we've got this grand plan, but that's not who he is. He's more of a technocrat, and as I discussed with him in the interview for JS on Politics, he's very defensively minded. He's trying to avoid making mistakes, and so he spends a lot of time with that posture, and he obviously has some problems with the crime issue. There is a reason that 54% of the people went to the polls and didn't vote for him. And I think the perceptions about crime are out there, and that's what Donovan's trying to hit him on.
Let's talk about the county executive's race, which has been on TV, at least, you know, from the Ableton side.
Right.
And also has that sort of Scott Walker feel, where both are comparing the other to Scott Walker and mailers and
it's
ads.
It's a bizarre thing that you have two Milwaukee Democrats, and certainly Chris Larson's no moderate, and you know, Chris Abley's fashioned himself as a moderate, but they're both trying to tag the other one by saying this person is more like Scott Walker. The problem is, you know, you have Chris Abley, who gave lots of money to Tom Barrett running against Chris Abley, running against Scott Walker. And on the other hand, you have Chris Larson, who ran off to Illinois to oppose Act 10. Both of them could say we're not close to Scott Walker, but that seems to be what the game is to get the other one tagged with that label.
Yeah, do you think voters, you know, will decipher it the same way we just did, or are they just going, well, yeah, Larson, Scott Walker, I don't like him, or Abley, Scott Walker, I don't like him, or how sophisticated are they on some of these arcane kind of bills and measures and
connections? You know, I think it depends on how closely they follow things, and I'm sure that there are people who have an axe to grind with Chris Abley, especially teachers or people in public schools or bus drivers, and I bet they're going to turn out and vote for Chris Larson. But I do think that there are some voters who just kind of don't pay that close of attention and go to the polls and, you know, are trying to figure out, oh, do I want to vote for the guy who's like Scott Walker, you know? And so it just might depend on how many ads they've seen, and they've probably seen a lot of Chris Abley ads.
a lot of them. I mean, we've got complaints from
parents. Will he see any Larson ads? Has he got enough money to
It doesn't appear that he has right now, but yeah, I mean, we've heard from parents who are upset that Chris Abley ads are turned up on their kids' YouTube channels and other things. So,
but for like preschool, though, right?
Yeah, right. So they are pretty much everywhere.
It's going to have the toddler road.
Yeah. And let's talk just real briefly on this same sort of question that we asked Jason earlier on the presidential turnout and things. So Barrett and probably Larson especially are really hoping for a strong Democratic presidential
it benefits
out, right?
Them.
Yeah,
it benefits
sure.
them as long as it's not resolved.
Right. I mean, Abley probably needs a little more, you know, suburbs.
It's hard to tell. I mean, he won all but two of the suburbs. So, I mean, he did well there. He lost the city by 9 points. And your point about this effectiveness of this strategy has to do with polling indicates about 50% of the people in Milwaukee County don't have an opinion about Chris Larson. So you might be able to associate that with him. But on the other hand, Chris Abley, and that's the problem with the presidential race, is he doesn't have really a natural base. There isn't a base for fiscal conservatives who are social liberals. So I'm assuming, and he indicated to us on JS on Politics that he's leaning in favor of endorsing Hillary Clinton. There was talk that Chris Larson was going to endorse Bernie Sanders, but neither of them have endorsed either at this point. But you're right. You would think that there's a natural affinity between the Sanders people and the Larson people.
All right. Let's turn to our some of the viewer questions we had. And one of them actually relates to an endorsement, because Obama this week endorsed Tom Barrett. So the
right.
question from Jefferson was, Obama endorsed Tom Barrett this week. Since when does the president get involved in local races?
Well, I think that, you know, Barrett and Obama have a long, they've known each other for a long time. Barrett has been a longtime supporter of Obama. Obama's made numerous trips to Milwaukee, not so much during the recall, but before and after. And so, it's interesting to see the president weighing in on a mayor's race, but given their longtime relationship, it's not super shocking.
Yeah, and there was even talk that the president nudged him to run in the recall, even though the president kept his distance once it started.
I assume that could help Barrett too, because you have Joe Davis in the primary. You know, presumably the African American vote
right.
isn't going to gravitate naturally toward Bob Donovan. So
no.
Sort of, but Obama's very popular there. So,
yeah, and I don't think that Bob Donovan's going to get an equal endorsement from anybody on the Republican side. He doesn't want that, I assume, at this point.
No, don't endorse me.
The next question is...
Thank you, Governor, stay in Madison.
This is from the reader or viewers, No Trump, who says, if Walker is going to endorse, he has to do it soon, right? Otherwise, it'll be meaningless and we'll wind up with Wisconsin voting for Trump. So do you think Walker endorses?
He said he's not going to before the election, before the primary.
So other governors will come out at the very last minute and...
But, you know, right now he's one of the least popular governors in America, and Craig Gilbert wrote that earlier. I'm not sure that that any one of these candidates really want his endorsement right now. And you can see this by the fact that his appointee, Rebecca Bradley, is running. How often do you see Scott Walker in any of her material or in her campaign ads? You just don't at this point.
All right, and our last question, this is from, it's a long name. It's John, parentheses, who hasn't been downtown in 15 years. I don't know if he answers to that when you talk to him or not. But his question
his
mom's
is, comes
to
John,
it's kind of long. It's hard to sign a check that way.
Right.
It says, you know, his question, which was delivered in all caps, so he's very serious about it, is why are we paying all this money for a streetcar downtown when the money could be used for other things in Milwaukee? The maintenance feature could be used for so much more. How foolish. So, let's first, the money couldn't be used for everything else because it's specific to transportation and streetcar.
A lot of it is federal.
But where does a streetcar become an issue? I mean, Donovan's made it an issue.
Mm-hmm. Donovan's trying to make it an issue. And there is a poll that indicates that less than 50% of Milwaukee voters support it. But in my conversation today with the mayor, he's going to push forward with it. And I tried to ask if this could eventually become a billion-dollar streetcar, and he said it could.
Because
he
can
see
it.
He wants to expand it and expand it and expand it. And so there is no limit on how much he sees being poured into the project.
Yeah, what's your sense among, you know, is there an appetite among aldermen to expand a project like that if it's going to be beyond, you know, grant money or among voters? How do you see that playing out?
I think that in some districts it's obviously really popular. There are people, I think, you know, in the Third Ward, in on the east side near the lake. And then I do think there are people who are hoping it'll go to the airport or Miller Park or other areas. I don't think that they want to have to be campaigning on, like, your tax dollars could flood into this project. I think right now they're pretty comfortable saying it's largely federal money. But, you know, I mean, I don't – I think after this election we'll hear more about people's long-term visions for it.
And I think it seems to be outraging people who haven't been in the downtown in 15 years.
People like John.
In Elm Grove, the project is not popular. Third Ward, much more popular. Yeah.
All right, well, we'll leave that discussion there for today with a note that next week's show will focus primarily on the mayor's race. So please tune in next week at the normal time to hear from Tom Barrett, and we'll have some tape and interviews, hopefully with Bob Donovan. Thank you.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,